Oh, come on, you're killing me, man. You're killing me. Bro, like, oh. That is like, yeah, super confidential. I can't say
that. House of Rugby Ireland, here on Joe. Game changed.
Hello and welcome to House of Rugby Ireland, here on Joe. For those of you watching on YouTube, you'd see we're going with the front row special on the show this week. For those of you listening, it's a real pleasure to welcome former Leinster and Ireland tight head Mike Ross and former Sharks and South Africa loose head Tende Matawira, the Beast, to the show. You're welcome, lads.
Thanks, bro. Actually, this fella, I just want to say first, this fella should come with a trigger warning for me. Because like I played three times against you, man, and I never got any change out of you. So, yeah, I get little flashbacks, little flashback seeing his face. But
yeah, we asked Mike to come on the show like a month ago, and he was all for it. And then I said, you know, by the way, the Beast is coming on, and he was like, he was second guessing himself, you know.
Yeah.
No, jeez, I think when I came onto the scene, you know, Mike, you would have been around for many years, man. So yeah. Actually, quite an honor to play against you.
Yeah.
You know, we had your friend Eben Estebeth on probably around 3 or 4 weeks ago now, and yeah, he actually, he was a great guest for us. But he told us a great story to bring up with you about your bus trip on the way to the World Cup final against England, and he said he was sitting a little bit up in the bus, and obviously people have the headphones in, people are getting focused and, you know, set up for the game, biggest game of their career, and they start hearing these roars from the back of the bus, you know, like these roars like a lion or some sort of wild animal. They just started getting louder and louder, and people are looking back. This was you, I hear. What exactly was going through your head?
Funny of Eben to share that story, because I think he was the only one that heard those sounds, because he sits right, you know, he used to sit right in front of me, and I guess, you know, it was all the excitement and everything, you know, before the game. I get pretty intense before, you know, a test match, and, you know, so I had my headphones on, and I was kind of grunting a little, I was listening to a bit of hip-hop. So he was like, what is going on? Are you okay? So I'm like, no, I'm fine, man. I'm just excited. I can't wait to get on the field. So he just, so he loves that story because apparently it sounded like a lion.
Yeah, well, never let the truth get in the way of a good story. That's what they say, Tende.
We were
doing a little bit of research and digging on you, and a couple of your other former teammates have helped us out with a couple of interesting stories as well. So one of them was on a place called Circus Circus. So this place Circus Circus, I believe it's a restaurant, is it?
Yes, it's a restaurant here in Durban.
Yeah, and you held a record. So can you give it? With what we've heard is they basically give you a steak, which is a kilogram in weight, 600 grams of French fries, and a liter of Coke, and you've got under 45 minutes to eat it, and if you eat it in under 45, you get it for free.
And this is
like your spot. You're going to this place every week. You must have been costing them a lot of money.
Yes, I was. I guess at the time, you know, I was 20 years old and young and poor. I didn't have much. So this was like a free meal for me. Every Thursday, me and my friends, we used to go out there. And the first time I did it in a record 12 minutes, man. Yeah, it was ridiculous. Like, what happened? Yeah, 12 minutes.
respect.
Yeah, we heard you got banned from that place.
Yeah, I was banned after a few times, you know, we went there because, they kept on reducing the time from 45 minutes to 40 to 30, and we still finished, you know. And they decided to kind of name us and shame us and tell us we're not allowed to come there anymore, man. So it was a bummer. I lost out on a free meal there.
Well, maybe someday we can get you and Mike together and you can have like a competition between the two of you. I wouldn't mind seeing that.
Yeah, well, you went to Argentina a few times, right? You've been to Argentina?
Yes.
Yeah, that's like prop heaven. You know, I mean, like, they have the big the steaks start at about 800 grams and they just go up. And, you know, they keep all the good Malbec there, so you're having that, and it doesn't cost as much, you know, to eat there.
So that's so true right now.
Yeah,
it's a great spot. Great spot to tour. There was another one that was mentioned. Yeah, and speaking of Argentina, Tende, there was another one of your teammates said that a few years ago. So can you just tell us which teammate this was for us? So a few years ago in Argentina, one of a teammate's alarm went off when you were in bed.
The files are coming out.
They're all throwing you under the bus, man. All these people that were supposedly friends. But what he said was, his alarm went off, which, this is quote from him, caused you to shit yourself and jump out of bed and threaten him.
Oh, my good friend Marcel Couture. So yeah, we were roommates, and then he always used to forget to put off his alarm, you know, at awkward times. And, you know, I think the time difference with us, you know, that we were quite far behind. I think it was about 9 p.m. and, close to 3 a.m. in South Africa. And I was tired and I was passed out already. And then next thing I hear this alarm going off, and I just went... Yeah, I went off it myself. I'm like, please turn off that alarm right now.
Brilliant, man. And then there was another one here. So, what Bulls player did you once say, Vucic, you fatty?
Oh, jeez. Oh, man. That's definitely from Ivan. I know he's the one that told you all that. So,
give us the background there.
I don't know if I should say this, because okay, it was this guy called Dean Grayling. Dean Grayling. So me and him were quite fierce competitors. He played the same position as myself. So every time when we went on the field, you know, it was like war. So I guess that day I just kind of lost it, and I said that. It was something along those lines.
That's correct, man.
Yeah.
Dean Grayling, and then just the last one there was, where did you get your nickname Panga from?
Oh, come on, you're killing me, man. That is super confidential. I can't say that on this. Obviously, you're not on TV right now, but you can't be seen by, you know, heard by people out there. Otherwise, I'm in trouble.
Okay, well, listen, this is a family show, so we'll leave that one out.
Yeah, we'll leave that one out. Yeah.
Fair enough, man. That's gas. You're probably disappointed that Eben wasn't on after you, because now you can't do what he's done to you, you know?
But if he wants to supply us with some info, return the favor, you probably could.
I can definitely do that.
Yeah, we might, to be honest, we might have to get him back on, because you've been doing pretty badly here, you know?
Yeah, no, they set me up properly.
But yeah, listen, Tende and Mike, I suppose I feel like I'm a little bit out of my depth here talking to you two guys about, you know, what goes on in the scrums, particularly in the front row union. But, you know, you guys have faced off against each other a number of times. And we'll start with you, Mike. Like, what are your memories of playing against Tende and South Africa in the times that you played for Ireland?
It's good. I mean, like, in fairness to Tende, he was never one of these chatters in the front row. He just did his job and got on with it. But my overwhelming memory of playing against you is like playing against a hydraulic ram, you know? So I go in and then the pressure just comes on like that. And that was why I always struggled with you, because of that surge of power. Like other props, it build it a bit slower, you know, and you can deal with that. But with you, it was just like on, and then I was off, and then it was just on, you know? So that was always, you know, the trouble I had. I think I got my last cap against you. I don't know if you remember 2016. I brought a few beers into the change room afterwards, because I had a notion that it could have been my last time wearing an Irish jersey. And that was nice. Like, I think we always got on fine after the games and tough competitors on it, but she was, yeah. I was always like sweating a bit the night before a match, you know, knowing
day,
that.
So what you're trying to say here is 10-day kind of forced you into retirement, is that?
He traumatized me, man.
I don't think so. For my side, you know, like Mike, you know, it was really an honor to play against you. I think, you know, to obviously play in your last Test match, it was special for me. And I think you brought a wealth of experience. And at the time, you know, I was also trying to, you know, kind of solidify my position in the Springbok team and, you know, reach all this in almost minor caps, man.
You were out injured for a bit before that, weren't you? You went through a spell of struggling with injuries,
I was injured, yeah. That's true.
Because I think I played against South Africa about 5 times maybe, and the other time it was CJ van der Linde was playing Lucid, you know, and I played with CJ at Leinster, and I knew if I just left CJ alone, if you don't irritate CJ, he's fine, you know? But if you poke the bear, you know, and I saw some props do that to CJ, I was like, oh man, you should just left him alone, because he'd have been fine otherwise. You're getting a bit pinged by
Tende,
the banner.
Tende, you can get your kids on as well if they want to jump on the show. You know, we can hear them in the background there.
Yeah, but I know they're like shouting. Yeah, you can see them down there. They're running around calling me.
Oh, you're good, man. You know, some of the just the detail that we have on you here on I suppose your experiences against Ireland as well, and your first game against Ireland was 2009, I think, November. You locked down against the famous John Hayes, who, you know, he played, I think, over 100 times for Ireland in the front row. What were your memories of that game a long time ago?
Yeah, I think it was a huge honour, you know, obviously playing. I think we played at Lansdowne Road, right?
Yeah,
it was a special stadium. I think one of the things I enjoyed about that stadium was the atmosphere, you know, the Irish fans singing, and it was a really special occasion. And I think, you know, I really wanted to, you know, get the ascendancy in that Test match. And I think John Hayes, exactly, had been around for a long time, played so many caps. So I just remember, you know, giving him quite a hard time, you know, in that specific game. And I think we won in the end, and it was a good experience, you know, to actually, like, you know, beat such a good Irish team at the time. I think, I don't know if Brian was still playing, Brian O'Driscoll, but
there were
some big names on that team, yeah. So, yeah, we got to win that game.
Yeah, for sure. And then I suppose for anyone that would have only seen you playing for South Africa and maybe wouldn't have seen the stepping stone that you had to take to get there, can you kind of give us a little bit of background on your kind of rugby journey, you know, from a youngster right up, and in a quick maybe?
Oh yeah, so I think so my story, I was born and raised in Zimbabwe, and I dreamt of playing professional rugby, and then obviously where I was, the circumstances were pretty hard and difficult. So the closest place for me to come and realize that dream was in South Africa. So I embarked on this journey as an 18-year-old, came to South Africa, and it was quite a daunting task, you know, because I was an unknown, and to make a name for myself. And how I did that, you know, was through hard work, you know, just, you know, pulling in the hours of work and really just imposing myself on the guys around me. And that's how, you know, I earned the respect of my peers, and obviously the name Beast got to be well known, you know, in the rugby circles in South Africa. And then I made my debut for the Sharks when I was 21 years old in 2007. And just became a fan favorite in the stadium with a chance of Beast, you know. It was like, you know, I became part and parcel of the culture of this side, and I embraced that, and I never let that get to my head. I stayed humble, you know, and just kept on working hard and letting my, you know, my work speak for itself. And, you know, I made obviously quite other challenges along the way. I made my debut for the Springboks in 2008. And then I got stopped by the Minister of Sport to play for the Springboks, because I didn't have a South African passport at the time, and it was quite a really big tough challenge on my part, and the one that just brought up my character, because I didn't lose hope. You know, I kept on believing that this whole situation was going to be resolved, and then before I knew it, I got back onto the field, because Archbishop Desmond Tutu, you probably know him, he's world famous.
Yeah.
So he's the one that came and intervened, and obviously got me my passport, and I was back on the field, and then obviously achieved so many more great things after that, with the World Cup victory in 2019 being the icing on the cake.
Yeah, that must have been the pinnacle. It's funny, because Eben actually said that you made that nickname up yourself.
Which nickname?
I'm
that
only is? Joking, man. I'm only playing. Yeah, no. Listen. In fairness, the journey that you have had, and that, you know, World Cup win that you guys had, and we talked to Eben about that, and just, you know, visibly how much that must have meant to the country and the players involved. You know, it must have just been phenomenal. What was the changing room like for you? You know, after you achieved that.
No, I think it was incredible. You know, it was surreal to actually, you know, imagine lifting that cup, you know, because of what we'd been through as a squad. You know, 2016 and 2017 were really tough years. You know, we had our backs against the wall, and the world of rugby had kind of thought that Springbok rugby has died, and we're never going to rise up from it. And thank God that we got Rassie back. You know, Rassie came in, and he was like, you know, he was the savior. You know, he's the one that came and just changed everything, got everything back in place, brought alignment, you know, and then brought everybody, you know, to actually buy into the vision. And then eventually we turned it all around and started winning, you know, games, and, you know, beat the All Blacks in 2016 in Wellington. That was probably the biggest confidence booster on this journey. And I think, you know, yeah, winning that cup in the change room, we kind of reminisced on the journey that it took to get there. And it was unbelievable for myself as a senior player. Yeah, it took a while to sink in, you know.
I'd say so. It looked particularly emotional for a lot of you. But just getting back into a little bit of the dark arts of the kind of front row, because as a back sitting here, and probably a lot of the listeners and the people that will be viewing, I'll hand this little bit over to you here. But just, you know, from playing in teams where the scrum has gone very well, I've played in teams when the scrum has gone badly, but it really is such a pivotal kind of point and a pivotal kind of strength for a team to have if you're going to win games. And I suppose my question is, just going into games and really big scrums, like what is the mentality, I suppose, during the week? Like, you know, what would you be talking about in terms of energy, in terms of, you know, targeting certain guys?
Well, it kind of depends who you're up against, you know. I mean, we all know if you're playing against England or South Africa, you know, you have to respect them, because they're going to go after you in the scrum, and they usually have the personnel to do it. You know, so there's often a particular focus in those weeks. And, you know, as you said, Ferg, I mean, you weren't actually bad when you were pressed into flanker action sometimes, you know, when you were sin-binned.
Well, I think
he was actually pretty good. He wasn't like Johnny May against England with his head, you know, in the wrong position. Ferg stayed down and he pushed, you know, so I was always happy to see you coming. But, yeah, it kind of sets the tone, doesn't it, Dendai? I mean, if you get a good first scrum and you're driving them backwards, then you start putting a little bit of seed of doubt into their forwards' minds. And if you keep attacking them, and every time they drop the ball, they go, shit, here comes another penalty. You know, it can really break teams, can't it? And, like, there's no better example of that than the World Cup final, where, you know, you did a very good job in England scrum, and they didn't have bad personnel playing. You know, I mean, Dan Cole is a good scrummager, you know, Joe Marler is a good scrummager, but they just didn't have an answer.
Yeah, certainly not, and I think...
Sorry,
Tendi, go on.
No, sorry, the budget there. I think I agree with you, Mark. You know, yeah, I think, you know, it depends exactly like you said, you know, on the opposition that you're facing, and that kind of focuses you to focus on certain you know, minute detail that is going to impact on how you scrummage on the weekend. So I think it's something that we as front rowers take a lot of pride in. And yeah, I think the scrum is, you know, it's a massive battle. You know, it's a place where you take a lot of confidence from. So when you get that first ascendancy, you get going forward. It's a domino effect, I believe. You know, your backs as well, you know, they end up also going forward. You know, it just has that huge psychological advantage on the other team. So I think that's what probably happened to us in that final. You know, that's what we got. You know, England couldn't just, you know, they couldn't fight back. It affected their backs. You know, they couldn't get, you know, yeah, just the free flow of play that they usually had, you know, especially against the All Blacks in the semi-final. So, you know, it takes a, yeah, especially in a test match, it's a huge, huge advantage to go forward at scrum time.
Yeah, definitely. I think the set piece, really, it's in big games, it can be a statement. It's a statement when it's going well, you know, whether it's line-out maul or scrum, when it's going well, you know, it sends fear into the opposition, and you can, it just, you know, it picks up the crowd and everything. And I think it's something that you guys leveraged in that World Cup massively. But with the front rows again, like, it seems like a real brotherhood in there, because, you know, the change rooms I've been in, the front rows always hang out together. They always go for coffees together. You know, like Mike, for instance, since he's finished, he has a little front row whiskey club. So they meet up. I'm kind of still waiting for an invitation here, you know. They meet up, try a few nice whiskeys. But were you the same over there? Do you guys stick close together at the front rows in South Africa?
Yeah, no, we definitely did. You know, we, it's a culture, you know, to always make sure that, you know, you kind of share moments, you know, either in triumphs or defeats or in disappointments. You know, we kind of, you know, it kind of brings you together. So it is something that probably Matt Proudfoot brought into the Springbok setup, to go out every week and have a meal and share a beer, you know, after a game, and just make sure that the front row is a family, because it is a special place to be. You know, it takes some very intelligent and talented folks to play in the front row. So, you have to embrace that and enjoy it.
Yeah, well, I think it helps that we all have a love of food. You know, generally works well in our favor.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's kind of like a certain type of person goes into the front row, and they tend to conglomerate together. You know, so if you're having a steak eating competition, it's generally get the front rows will be first to the trough, you know?
Yeah, well, I find it ironic that 10 days, like, oh yeah, we used to always hang out together and go for meals. It's like, yeah, well, your meals sounded like they only took 12 minutes in Circus Circus, so you're not going to hang out too long there, you know?
No, there's beers afterwards, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I suppose one other thing I was going to touch on, Tende, was you would have seen that international test match that England came over and played Ireland in the last game of the Six Nations, and there was a tweet you put up after Ellis Genge, another front rower that you guys would be familiar with. You know, there was, I don't know if it looked like elbows or something was thrown on the ground, and there was handbags anyway, and you threw up a tweet just saying he needed to be sorted out. Would he tempt you to come out of retirement to have a pop off him?
I think I got asked that question quite a few times. Now, I guess, you know, for me, you know, I just believe that what earns you respect out there, especially as a front row, it's the way you scrummage, you know, it's the way you impose yourself on the opposition, you know, your work rate around the field, and how you just go about, you know, your game, and you don't get involved in this argy-bargy stuff, you know, and, you know, have all this sideshow. So I just felt like, Elliot Genge has got so much potential. He's letting himself down by getting involved in this, you know, yeah, just there's a small little unnecessary, you know, battles that actually, you know, it's probably costing the team, you know, as a whole, you know. So I just believe that it's got a negative impact on the game, especially in the front row. I guess how I judge front rows is how they scrummage, you know. I think same, probably, you know, for like Mike, you know, he just went about his business and he did it, you know, did it to the best of his ability. And guys, you know, front rows that have been, that have been, you know, iconic out there in that field that have, you know, have had lasting legacies. You know, they've just gone about their business and done their job really well. You know, like Owen Franks, you know, guys that are quiet, they don't get involved and, yeah, and stuff that isn't necessary. So I just felt that Eddie's game is getting involved in too much of this. Unnecessary.
I always had the attitude as if you had enough breath to talk after a scrum, you weren't putting enough effort in. You know, so, you know, like you said, just do your speaking in the scrum. And, you know, because, like, just chat afterwards, it's just wasted energy.
You guys definitely did that. I tell you what, though, Tende, Johnny Sexton will be happy enough for you to be volunteering yourself as his bodyguard anyway.
Look, Sexton probably deserved it.
Yeah. But but listen, Tende, before we let you go, we'd love you to tell us about the Beast Foundation and what it's all about.
Yeah, so the Beast Foundation is probably one of the more very exciting projects that I'm involved in. It's a vehicle that I created to give back in a big way, because all along my career, you know, I got a lot of assistance financially. You know, I had people putting me up when I didn't have a place to stay. And I came, you know, from rock bottom, you know, and I relied on people's kindness and generosity. And now that I, you know, I achieved so much, you know, through God's blessing, you know, and God's favor, and I want to do the same for you know, the future generation. You know, I want to help young kids, you know, achieve their ultimate dreams out there. So my mission is to empower the youth through the platform of sport, education, and life skills development. And we're focusing on building the whole individual, you know. We're not just focusing on one aspect of their lives, you know, like their talent or sports or anything. We want to create wholesome human beings that can become, you know, future leaders of Africa one day, you know, that can really, change things. Because as you know, we have a lot of issues in Africa. You know, there's a lot of, there's a huge socioeconomic disparity, you know, a lot of poverty. So how we can overcome that is by empowering the next generation. I believe that strongly. So that's what the Beast Foundation is all about.
Fair play, man. That's a pretty cool thing to get involved in, particularly from your background, and then just seeing the bigger picture. Because I think, you know, the three of us are retired, but when you're caught in the rugby bubble, you know, it's sometimes very easy not to see the bigger picture of you know, where people come from, you know, and how tough it can be for some people. So to have that sort of a thing going on must be pretty rewarding for you.
No, thank you. No, it is definitely rewarding. You know, I see the many lives that we're already touching, you know. It's just so special. It's a really nice feeling, you know, to help others climb their own ladder of success. You know, because I remember at one stage in my life, I was that young kid who just had a dream, you know, nothing much, and I wanted to realize that dream. So, yeah, so there's so many others like me out there. So, yeah, I want to create opportunities for them.
Fair play. Well, Tende, before we let you go, just one or two more things to ask you about, just quickly back to the rugby, because if we have to touch on the Lions Tour, of course. Now you can be nice and objective, the fact that you're not playing anymore, but what's the feeling like back in South Africa? You know, there's been a lot of uncertainty about whether it's going ahead, whether it's not, and obviously now it is, and, you know, where are people's heads back home? I'd say everyone's very excited.
Yeah, everybody is excited. You know, there's a lot of hype already. You know, there's obviously a bit of uncertainty around having fans in the stands. You know, that's what people are waiting for mainly. But the players, I can tell you, you know, they're relishing the opportunity to face the Lions. It's a special occasion. You know, I got to be a part of it in 2009, and it was surreal. And, it's great that tradition was not broken and the Lions are coming to South Africa and not the Springboks going to the UK. That is very important, you know. So the tradition is intact. And I think that, it's going to be a big battle, because the Lions will be highly motivated. You know, they want to revenge the loss of 2009. And there's also been other, you know, things that happened at the World Cup, you know, with the Springboks beating England and Wales in the semi-final. you know, so there's a, yeah, so there's a bit of, yeah, there's a bit of, you know, yeah, some bitter feelings there. So, yeah, so and on the other side as well, when you look at the Springboks, the guys have been relishing, you know, the opportunity to wear a Springbok jersey again, because we, when we last played, was the World Cup final. That's the last game that the Springboks played. So the guys are keen to get back on the field again and just, yeah, play and to the best of their ability and represent South Africa. So, yeah, I can't wait to watch, man. I'm going to be a fan and screaming my lungs out.
Yeah, well, the fact that we've got the two front row specialists here today, it'd be wrong for us not to get you to pick your picks. So, Mike, what are your picks for the Lions? And then we'll go with Tende from South Africa.
Front row only.
Front row only,
okay,
yeah.
So I reckon Tadhg Furlong, probably a tight head. But after that, then, Kyle Sinclair, possibly. And Lou said, I'm going back Cian Healy to get there.
Yeah, fair play.
Yeah. And Wyn Jones from Wales, I would say, has a good shout. And then the fifth prop.
Yeah, we want you to give our three, Mark, not our six. Do you know what I mean? Like the three starters.
But we were talking tight heads and loose heads, man.
Yeah, I know. But if we want you to put your neck out and give us a pick. Like, who's your starting front row?
Test front row. Okay. Right, I'm probably going to go with Tadhg, a tight head. I would say Ken Owens, a hooker.
Mm-hmm.
And Cian Healy, a loose head.
That's fair enough. What about you, Tende, from South Africa's perspective?
Yeah, that's a good front row, Mike. I like Ted Furlong very well. I think from the Springboks, definitely Stephen Kitsoff, no doubt. Then Uka Bongi or Malcolm. Okay, I'll say Bongi. And then Tite Frans Malherbe. So there's nice continuity there as well from the World Cup. So a lot of experience in those guys.
Yeah, definitely. Is there any players from the Lions, and obviously you're not involved anymore, that you'd be looking at going, that you hope they don't come, you know, because you think they're extreme? Well, they might be a big threat to, you know, causing South Africa issues.
Yeah, I definitely think, like Mario Toji, I think he's an exceptional player. I think he's been a headache to every team that he faces. So I think he's going to be one of those weapons that the Lions are going to try and utilize, especially, you know, line outs and around the field. You know, it's got a crazy work rate. So, yeah, I think he's going to be a thorn in our sides. But, it's going to be tough, you know. But I know the Springboks will have equally, you know, tough guys. And, you know, like Eben, it's a bit, you know, he's just unreal, super talented player. One of my best friends. He's probably going to kill me if I don't mention his name. So.
Jeez, you're still going to call him one of your best friends after what he's done to you here today?
Hey, I think I might need to relook at that, because yeah, he set me up properly.
Definitely. Well, listen, Tende, before we let you go, Shock Burger tells us that you do a mean impression of Barry White.
Oh my gosh. No, I guess for my wife, she thinks, you know, I do a mean impression of
Go on, go on. Here, give us
a verse.
Go on, sing us part one. Go on.
You're at the front of the bus now. Come on. It's your first cap. Go on.
No.
Well, give us 10 seconds.
Go far in the good way, man.
That'll be a good exposure. Be good exposure for for your security company, man.
Yeah.
Next time, I'll save it for next time when I come on the show. I'll practice beforehand.
Okay.
Here, you've been a gent on the show, man. Thanks a million for coming on. We really enjoyed it.
No, it's such a pleasure, man. Thanks for having
Cheers,
me. And take care, man. Cheers, mate. Cheers. Thank you.
House of Rugby Ireland. Tell us what you think by comment and rating us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts.
For part two of the show, we've got Ian Madigan fresh from Belfast. Welcome, Mads.
Yeah, great to be back, Dan. Great to see you, Mike.
Good to see you too, Mads. Been too long.
I know. I only ring you if I'm trying to sell you something.
Exactly.
like the rest of us that are retired. Before we look back on some old stories and talk about some memories together and particularly Mike's career, I wanted to touch quickly on the Irish women's defeat to France on Saturday, 56-15. What did you make of the game?
Very disappointing from an Irish perspective, considering you know how well they played the previous week against Wales. You know, it was probably one of their best performances under Adam Griggs. Ultimately, it was. It kind of just shows a gulf, like the French team are kind of semi-pro, and you know, Ireland are still amateur, and it kind of showed. I mean, like at the moment, there's a bit of a, like a two-tier system in women's rugby opening up. You kind of got New Zealand, England, and France, and then there's a bit of a gap, and then everyone's trying to make it up. But ultimately, you know, if you can dedicate yourself full time to it, it makes a huge difference. And that was unfortunate. I think was the difference between the two teams at the weekend.
Yeah, like we had Michelle in last week, and she was saying, you know, how important it was that Ireland's discipline had to be at its best, and it was 20 penalties against them. That made it really hard for them. But on top of it, like it wasn't like the French team are, you know, 35, 40 points better than the Irish team. The Irish team didn't play well. You know, and on our day, like I think the girls know that they can go toe to toe with that French team.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot more in them. I on the plus side, you know, since the Dunforce break, I think they've been looking fitter and fitter than ever. You know, they play Bevan Parsons. I was lucky enough to have been coaching the women's scrum in the 2017 to the middle of 2019. And, you know, when I first got there, there's a couple in the squad who couldn't even do a complete full line-out lift, and they worked really hard on getting upper body strength up. And you can see the evolution. I mean, if you look back at where they were, but even like 2 years ago, there's a lot of knowledge and experience disappeared out of the team after the 2017 World Cup when you had a bunch of retirements. I think Claire Malloy had more caps than the rest of them put together. And there's always going to be some kind of growing pain there as people, as women, as they get experience, you know, as you've got, like I mentioned, Bevan Parsons, you know, she's probably the wave of the future. And like the other thing you have to take in consideration is a lot of the players there would have only taken up rugby relatively later in life, like when they go to college. So you miss out on those kind of 10 years of development that you get at the underage stage. So, yeah, like you're seeing like the new breed coming through, like Bevan, who's had a ball in her hands since she was, you know, minis. And that's ultimately what we need to get to, is to start producing more.
I think the semi pros versus amateurs is the biggest thing, really, you know, like, and they did perform so well against Wales. Yeah. You know, who were also amateurs, but then coming up against the likes of France and England, like, it's very challenging, really, you know, when...
So it is important that they bounce back this week. Yeah. You know, next team in the chasing pack, trying to chase down, the you know, effectively the professional teams that they're coming up against.
I think it's, like, the thing they've struggled with, and, you know, it's not just the Irish women's team that this happened, it happened to the Irish men's team as well, it's consistency of performance.
Yeah.
You know, you have one good game, then you lose a game, then you bounce back and have another good game, and then it's just kind of that little roller coaster that that they suffer from. But yeah, look, the game against Scotland next week, I say they should win that, and hopefully start to start building on that going forward.
Yeah, because if they beat Italy next weekend, they'll be in a position to finish third, which will qualify for them for the top tier for this new World 15 competition. So that would be something to aim for, at least for them, you know. Yeah. So I presume you guys would have saw the headlines there in the last few days. Simon Zeebo is returning to Munster and will be back in the frame to play for Ireland again. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it was great to see Zeebs come back. You know, aside from his rugby ability, like commercially, it's a great signing as well. He's the kind of guy who gets bums on seats. You know, season ticket sales will go up off the back of it. Jersey sales will go up off the back of it. And he offers real depth, you know, whether it's on the wing or at fullback. He's a great option there, you know, to come in and compete with the likes of Mike Haley. It's great for Munster. It's great for the Rainbow Cup for next season. And he's the kind of guy that you need there for the Heineken Cup to get over those top sides. And that's probably where Munster have struggled over the last couple of seasons. So I'd say they'd be delighted to get him back.
Yeah, and he'd be put himself. I'd imagine the big reason for him. I know, listen, he's a proud Munster man. But a big reason for him coming home would probably be to have one eye on that, you know, 2023 World Cup, and the fact that when you're playing away, you're not going to get picked. So that'll be in the forefront of his minds. And then again, you had another announcement there with Scott Fardy, announced his retirement at the end of the season. And you guys didn't play with Scotty, but
no, I was always loved watching him because he was such a ruck pest. You know, you watch him at any ruck, yeah. And he's inevitably in there messing it, whether he's slowing down the ball or whatever. I met him briefly at one kind of preseason game when he first joined, and yeah, I thought that he'd be perfect, exactly the type of guy I'd like to play with. You know, so yeah. What's he like, Ferg?
Yeah, I suppose like you guys were there when Leinster recruited well. You were there when Leinster recruited badly. Yeah. You know, and I think Scott is an example of one of the best signings Leinster have ever made. He'd be right up there with Issa. You know. Because it's about, you know, it's about recruiting good rugby players, but it's about recruiting good people that actually fit into your, you know, the identity and the culture you have in a team. And he was such a great fit. I think the fact that he wasn't playing for Australia anymore, and, you know, he had that experience from a few different environments, obviously played the Brumbies, then played in Japan previously as well, loads of experience playing the World Cup final, and then coming back, not playing test rugby and being available for those games when the Irish internationals were away, and just a brilliant rugby player as well. He'll be sorely missed by the lads in the change room and from Leinster as well. You know, those younger second rows will have to step up now with him gone.
Yeah, and Dev's the older statesman there now, isn't he?
Dev's the older statesman. Dev's the kind of Malcolm O'Kelly of this. I remember when I came in, when we were there together from the earlier days in Leinster, Malcolm was one of the older, really more experienced guys, and Dev is kind of that person there for the younger guys coming through.
Yeah, I remember when I was coming to the end of my tenure, I was looking around the dressing room, and you probably got this too, Ferg, and you're going, all right, I've no, not that you've no mates left, but you've no friends in the same kind of bracket as you, you know, with kids, married, you know, over 35, you know, that kind of way. But yeah, like, and the Dev's going to be looking around going, you know.
So you're trying to say Dev's got no mates next year?
He's got no mates. No mates.
No, but Sean Cronin's left. He's got Nugget left.
That's the thing. There's not a lot of people in the dressing room now. They're at the same stage of life that Dev's going
to
be.
Yeah, and that's a testament to Dev's durability and how Leinster just really need him. You know, they've got, like, those young guys are going to be brilliant, but you need an experienced guy like Dev. He hasn't been getting picked for Ireland anymore. They'll have him around a lot, and he'll be invaluable for them. But the next thing that I was going to bring up there was just that the Rainbow Cup. So there was a few weeks back we were wondering, was this going to go ahead? Was it cancelled and stuff like that? There seems to be, it is going to forge ahead, but there seems to be new rules in place.
Yeah, so they've brought in three new rules. The first one being red cards now. It's not a permanent, you know, exiting of the game. That player who gets red carded has to stay off, but he can be replaced after 20 minutes, which I think is a welcome change, because you're not going to have games ruined like we had, you know, the Leinster-Ulster game where Andrew Warwick got sent off after 20 minutes. You know, it's going to make it very difficult to keep that competitive. It's not impossible, but it's very hard. So I think it is good, but I think there's still probably certain red cards that you shouldn't be able to replace, like if it's really foul play or something like that.
I don't think anybody minds losing a player for the duration if he's poked the head off someone, you know, or he's losing someone's face.
Yeah.
You know, but like, you know, maybe getting the timing of a tackle slightly wrong or the height, then you should get punished for it. But, you know, like you said, you know, it shouldn't change the outcome of the game as much as it does.
Yeah. And like, I think all three rules, the rule changes, you know, they have good parts and bad parts. The captain's challenge is another one. Mm-hmm. So it's one captain challenge per game. And if you're successful with your challenge, you hold on to it. So, like, it's good. And, like, what I like about that is hopefully it's going to rule out players bickering to referees and going, you know, oh, there was a knock-on back there, or there was a high shot three phases ago, or, you know, the ref can now go, if you want to do a captain's challenge, go to your captain.
Yeah.
I'll deal with your captain, and you can use it. And if you're right, you'll hold on to it. If it's wrong, I'm not going to hear from anyone from your team for the rest of the game. Yeah. And I'd like to see referees, you know, if they are getting players mouthing off, that they just go straight to penalty. And if, you know, consistently happening, yellow card players, get them off, because it's something that's very much crept into the game, that players feel now that they can appeal to refs.
Yeah,
like a running commentary,
And some people making a meal as well. At times, you know, like are screaming at the ref after a ruck. It was a neck roll. Look at it. You know,
yeah.
That's the cap. If the captain is allowed to do that, and there's a challenge see if there's a try scored from several phases. And there might have been a neck roll. Yeah, the captain can go up, but the players shouldn't be shouting at a referee in the middle of a game, distracting them, doing that stuff. I agree with that. There was another one there, the goal line dropout. What's that about?
Yeah, so obviously when if a team puts a grubber through, it's in the in-goal area, you dot it down. At the moment, it's a 22 dropout. That's now changed to a goal line dropout. So you have to take the drop kick from behind your own try line. Now, for missed penalties and missed drop goal attempts, it's still taken from the 22, which I don't really understand, because if anything, that, like, in my opinion, they're the restarts that should be taken from the in-goal area. Because if you've given away a penalty 5 yards from your line,
yeah,
and you know they decide to go for a kick from the corner, the kick just misses, and then the team's restarting from the 22 and you're back in your own half. You haven't had any reward from potentially a very good passage of play leading up to the other team infringing. But what's positive is, and you know, Ross, you touched on it when we were talking before the show, is we could see more attacking kicks now, because if the attacking kick doesn't work out and the team catches it in the in-goal area or dots it down, it's only a restart from in the in-goal area.
Yeah. So, like, how's it going to work, though? I think I've read the rules. It said without delay, you know, so you catch and you have to kick it straight away, or...
On the restart?
Yeah, on the restart. Do you know anything more about that?
Yeah, I'm not sure how that's going to work. Like, we went through the rules during the week. We had a big meeting on it, and Dan had a list of questions off the back of it that he wanted to go back and go, well, what if this happens? What if that happens? So there's going to be a bit of clearing up in the first probably few games.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a bit of... there's risk-reward with that goal line dropout. Because if you think about an attacking kick, so if you get a clearance kick and you can land it in the in-goal area and get a really good chase, like, that's a massive... That could be a really massive territory gain for... Mm. But at the same time, if it goes dead, it's a scrum back. So I'll be interested to see how teams kind of approach that, you know what I mean?
But yeah, look, I think a short competition, it's not a bad time to trial new laws. And like the captain's challenge works brilliantly. I watch a lot of the NRL, and there's a fair bit of strategy behind it. You don't want to pull your captain's challenge too early and then not be able to use it when the game's really close with, you know, 10, 15, 20 minutes to go, and you've already used your captain's challenge for something that, you know, didn't work out. So, you know, it will be interesting to see how that is used.
Yeah, definitely. And Mike, listen, it's great to get you on the show today, but I suppose I'd love to talk through kind of your journey, because it was probably a more unconventional one than people. You know, people just saw you coming to Leinster, you know, being very successful with Leinster, and then being very successful with Ireland under Declan Kidney and Joe Schmidt. But it was a road kind of less travelled, really. And if you could kind of give us a little kind of summary of kind of the route you took.
Yeah, okay. So, like, I grew up in a small village called Ballyhooly, and I went to the local town rugby club. So I started there under 11s, Fermoy Rugby Club. And I also went to... The school I went to was St. Coleman's in Fermoy. Not a big rugby school, shall we say. They're massively into the hurling. They won the Hearty Cup twice there, which is kind of equivalent to, like, the Munster Senior Cup in rugby, you know. So, and they won the All-Ireland twice, too, while I was there. So they're a very good hurling school. So I played away with Fermoy underage until I was about 18, 19. And then I went to UCC. And went to UCC 4 years. When I first joined, you'd like to Peter Stringer and Mick O'Driscoll and Gerry Flannery were playing. So, you know, the AIL was kind of on that cusp, but they still had a lot of professional players playing in the AIL. So I played there for 4 years, and then I moved over to Cork Conn, and I played there for another 4 years. And eventually, it's quite funny. So I knew it was about time to... You know, either I was going to make the transition to being professional or I wasn't. And interesting enough, so my dad was talking to Leo Cullen's dad, and his dad gave him the number. And Leo was Cullen Frank again, also the same as my dad, gave my dad the number of an agent, a guy called Justin Page. And Justin also happened to be Dean Richards' agent. So I got a trial for Harlequins in the summer of 2006. And a few months previously, I'd lost my job. I was working in a lab, and Dickie invited me to train in with Munster. So it kind of got me up a level. So when I got the trial, it was a 3-month trial, I was able to take the opportunity as it presented itself. I had to play 2 trial games before they offered me the trial. So I played with their A team twice and those went well, and then he offered me a 3-month contract in the back of that. So
he played some amount of games for Harlequins though, because consecutively, was there not something? I remember Bob Casey was telling me.
One time. So in my second year there, I played 18 consecutive 80 minutes on the bounce.
That's incredible.
Yeah,
that's the premiership, isn't it?
That's the premiership for you. But like, I needed that though. You know, at my stage in development, I was able to. I didn't have. I call myself a classic car with not a lot of miles on the clock. So I turned professional at 26. You know,
yeah,
so that's,
which is old. You don't see that now. Like, you know.
No. Yeah. And so I played. Was it 83 games for Harlequins over 3 seasons, and just loved it. Really enjoyed it, and. In February around 2009, Cheka came calling. And I was looking over at Leinster, you know, winning Heineken Cups. They played in that Bloodgate game, for example.
Okay, yeah.
You know, and I was like, well, they've got Stan, there's CJ there. So, like, where do I fit into this equation, you know? And I think CJ had a long-term injury or something. And
he had a toe injury. He was totally pretty much.
Yeah, and, you know, Stan was also could also play Loosehead. So and I knew... You know, if I wanted to play for Ireland, which I think every player ultimately wants, I had to go home because I was getting released for camps at times. But the way the premiership works is, you know, England pay the premiership to release players, English players for camps, and Ireland weren't going to do that. So, you know, we were only released when they were obliged to release us in the international window. So, yeah, I took a punt, came back to Leinster, and... the first season, I thought I made a serious mistake here, you know, because first couple months went fine. Stan was out injured, so I was getting picked. And then I made this dumb mistake against London Irish at home in the first European Cup when the Leinster were defending their title. I kind of, you know, running back from a ruck and the ball squirts out in front of you and it just reflexively kicked it. And the London Irish slotted the penalty, won the game. And...
I think Ryan Lamb kicked that, didn't he? I can't remember that game.
And Chex was not in a forgiving mood after that. So.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah.
What year was that? Was it 2007?
2009. 2009-2010 season. And so I was almost kind of like pulling the ejector seat there because like, I was getting picked every week and over in Harlequins. And, you know, I mean, like, I think the low point came during that season when I had this big callus right here. And I was like, what the hell is this from? Because we were not doing a lot of boxing. You know, it wasn't, there was nothing, no exercise I was doing that. Yeah. And then during one session, it hit me. It was from holding tackle bags.
Oh my God, that is not good. Like, yeah. That is not good.
Yeah, it was so, I was looking like, why is it? Yeah. Oh.
You were just going to sleep at night with a bib on because it was just easier for you to go in and keep it that way.
Yeah.
Strapping your hands up before training to hold the pads.
Yeah, it's just so dark, you know. And I used to go with a few of the lads like Ronnie McCormack and, you know, we were training David Lloyd's at the time and you'd go down past the tennis courts and we'd go for like a cappuccino or, you know, I call them sappuccinos. You could just like have a little sapping session and moan and bitch about not getting selected. And
Yeah, in fairness though, like once you did get your opportunity in Leinster, you know, you were one of those players under Joe Schmidt really that he trusted for a long period of time. And, you know, like the majority of your caps for Ireland came under him, fair bit of success.
Yeah.
Like, did you send him back any money when you finished up?
I think he was making enough of himself. But yeah, look, I think I of all the medals I ever won, all of them except one was under Joe. You know, so you know, the two Heineken Cups, the 2 6 Nations. You know, I think there was one Pro 14 medal I got under Matty, but the rest of them, you know, was all down to Joe.
I think we can all vouch for just how much he got out of his players, Joe Schmidt, and you know, people can say what they want about him, but at the end of the day, for the people that were coached under him, very intense, obviously the environments and the long Six Nations were exhausting, but at the end of the day, when you were winning them, like it was worth it. And the stuff he did in Leinster, he brought us to a new level. But the three of us were kind of, you know, we were three players that were lucky to have him in both Leinster and Ireland, really, weren't we?
Very much so. I think one of the big things with Joe is like the way he would have treated you would have been very different to Mike and would have been very different to me. And that was a real skill that Joe had. He had a good kind of sense of how he could get the most out of each individual within the team.
Mm-hmm. It was funny though, because when he first came along, we had lost a few games. I think we lost one to the Benetton, we lost over in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, oh, this guy's too soft, because he wasn't kicking tackle bags around and breaking coach's box like Cheka was. But like, yeah. You know, how little did I know, you know? And yeah, we soon found out that no.
Yeah, because the first year he came in would have been when the World Cup was going on. So yeah. It was a very young squad. You know, Leinster traditionally are usually a bit slow out of the blocks. Mm-hmm. And I think he lost maybe three of his first four league games.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But very quickly turned it around.
Yeah, he did. And yeah, there was a classic headline, Joe Schmidt has lost the dressing room after three games. But yeah, we could see what he was trying to do. And it was just, once it clicked for us, we didn't look back.
I know, and I suppose, like, as a head coach, from the head coach of a coach, but yeah, Cheks was one, but really, Cheks would lose it, but actually otherwise, you know, he would be kind of a very approachable guy. I found Joe definitely in camp with Ireland, it was mm-hmm. different. I think people were scared of their life of Joe, like, grown men were scared of their life of Joe. He had, you know, the ruling was, if you're not 5 minutes early for a meeting, you're late. And yeah. That started to spiral. Like, lads were turning up 10 minutes early sometimes. You come down, you go, Jesus, is it started? But yeah. There was...
Doing a walkthrough, you'd have your boots and your gum shield on. Like, you know, it'd be like 7 o'clock on a Sunday in Carton House. And like, yeah. you're like psyching yourself up. You've got all the notes, like, or all the plays written on your hand because you're afraid that you mightn't run the right lines in a walkthrough.
Yeah, like there's no fear. Like you're suddenly sitting down reading your phone, and then you look up and you're alone in the room, and you're just like, "Where the hell am I supposed to be? You know, where is everyone?"
But you had that one, Mike, before that international. Who was it against?
It was against Wales. So, the previous day, I was late for a walkthrough. There's always a walkthrough the morning of a match, and. The previous day, I'd just been feeling ropey, like I had some sort of tummy bug or something. And I went down for breakfast that morning, and I had breakfast, and I just didn't feel good. So I thought, I'll go back to bed. I'll put the head down here for an hour before the walkthrough, and it'll help me settle. And the next thing I know, Mick Kearney's hammering on my door, and Mick Kearney's a team manager, and you do not want him. If he's knocking on your door, something is seriously wrong,
yeah,
right?
He's not saying how are you.
So I was like, shit, like I slept through my alarm, or I double-thumbed my alarm. It just didn't go off. And so I was late for the walkthrough. The walkthrough was in Stevens Green, which is right in front of Shelburne. So I probably, you know, threw on the clothes as quick as I've ever had it, you know, cold sweat pumping through my forehead, you know, running down, and then... You know, Joe's staring like blue laser daggers at me, and
because I'll never forget. Because we all, you know, if anyone's ever late, he'd straight away notice if anyone is late. Number one, but obviously, with your tight head prop for a walkthrough, you're going to notice if he's not there.
Yeah.
So people looking around, where's Mike? And I'll never forget you coming out, and I was I was on the bench, I think, for that game, and I was looking over, and then I was nudging. Nugget, or it even could have been you. So that Sean or Cronin or you, I was like, oh, look at this, man. And it was you, like, sneaking into Stephen's Green. We're in the walkthrough there, and you could see Mike was like, he was tiptoeing up, like, high behind a tree. And he tiptoed up, high behind another tree.
No.
It wasn't far off. You did try and sneak in.
Yeah.
But the sweat beating off your forehead, I'll never forget it.
It's the fear, you know.
It's the fear that Joe can put into grown men. I can remember even with, you know, when you were starting off in Leinster, we were playing Bath away. And I remember, like, we didn't really know the value of walkthroughs and how, you know, important Joe saw them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were probably something that had been around for a few years, but you just box-ticking exercises.
Oh, this one, Darce in the coffee.
Yeah, Darce comes out. And, like, he was probably a minute or two early. And he made the mistake of bringing out a cup of coffee, and I think he had a saucer underneath. Joe just let out this roar, you know, and, you know, coffee went everywhere. And
did he have a pair of slippers on as well?
I think he could have had his pair of slippers.
He had a pair of slippers.
The hotel ones.
That's not even adding to the story. Yeah,
No, I think he did. Yeah. But like, it was very much Joe kind of setting the tone of, I want everyone switching in for these. You know, there's calculated messages that he sends out. Like, you know, it's not like he was a hothead and he just lost his temper. There's a lot of the time he's doing stuff and there'd be reason behind it.
You know, or you might call someone out, and like you said, in a calculated fashion, and everyone gets the message straight away without him having to, oh, jeez, he said that to him. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I know, he's one of those coaches. There was a bit of fear there amongst guys. Like, there was one time before we played Australia in November, I think it was 2014. Yeah. So during the week, myself and Rob Carney were out for a coffee. We're walking by the joke shop there on Stephen's Green, and we're like, geez, we'd be gas. We grabbed a few these glucose sweets. They're joke sweets. So they look normal, but they taste funny. Brought them to the team room and put them in a bowl on a little desk like that, the one in the team room that everyone is sitting around watching. So when no one is around, me and Rob put them down. We just got the garlic ones because we asked them in the joke shop which are the really strong sweets. The garlic ones are really rotten once you start chewing into them. Put them down, and then anyone who's coming in, we're obviously going to tell them, you know, these are glucose sweets from Ruth Wood Martin, who was the then nutritionist at the time. Yeah. They're beautiful, you know, apple drop sweets. Really, really nice. So next thing, first person that walks in, Joe Schmidt, right? And of course, he clocks the little thing of sweets, and he goes, picks one up, starts opening. My life is just flashing in front of my eyes. I was like, oh my God. So, but we were watching a game or something on the TV, so I was kind of watching the game, but I was like, oh Jesus. So he starts sucking it, like, he's talking to me and Robert actually taste them before we came back just to see how rotten they were, and they're horrible, but it takes a little while for the taste to set in, you know. Yeah. So I was sitting there going, oh gee, just looking across. He's sucking around, he's like, he kind of sucking it in. And he just goes, what the fuck is that? spat it out and threw it on the floor. So we had to come clean to him. Ironically, that was my last start for Ireland. Funnily enough, last start for Ireland there. So probably not the best idea to do that to a head coach. But moving on into just the front row at the moment, Mike, in Ireland, and where you see some of the potential and some of the bolters maybe, you know, for Ireland next week or next year from some of the performances from the provinces.
Look, we have the established internationals like Tadhg and Andrew Porter, and you know John Ryan and on the loose head side obviously Keane and Dave Kilcoyne and Ed Byrne. But if you're looking below that, I mean you've two really good young props in Ulster, in Tom O'Toole and Eric O'Sullivan. Mm. You know, actually, I think Eric is like a clone of Jack McGrath sometimes, you know.
Yeah, he wouldn't quite have the size that Jack
with
would
the scrum
have,
cap on.
With the scrum cap and the mustache.
Scrum cap on, but yeah, he's a very mobile. I think loose heads now, you kind of have to be mobile.
Yeah.
And he certainly ticks that box. But yeah, himself and Tom O'Toole, as you mentioned, Tom is someone who I think could be, you know, could definitely make that step forward to the international stage. Now, obviously, I don't know the scrums inside out, but
I was watching him. I always watch scrums, right? If they're on TV, I'm watching them. And Tom struggled in the early half of his career with scrummaging, but like the last few years has really, really come on that, right? And you know, I think if you're looking, I mean, like obviously Marty's there as well, but we're just keeping it kind of like the younger age bracket. Like Tom, I think will have a nice career in an Irish jersey, you know, because like he's got all the brown field bits. He needed to work on his scrummaging. He's done that, so yeah, I think he's definitely one for the future. If you look around other provinces, like Roman Salanoa went from Leinster down to Munster. I think he's a lot of raw power for you. Probably would have.
Yeah, he's extremely strong. Yeah,
yeah. And they have Keenan Knox down there. Mm. He was originally from South Africa. Jack Anger also moved from Leinster down to Connacht, and you know, like so. Jack, I remember watching Jack playing under 18s at the age of 16. So he's always been a talent coming through. Mm. So, but what all those guys need is game time, because that's the only thing that'll accelerate the growth of a young prop. You know,
yeah, definitely.
You need to have. I mean, when Tadhg was coming up, he had a couple of bad days in the scrum, but he hasn't had them since, you know. You need to have, get your pilot's wings, you know, get sent up into the air. But once you've that done, then you grow a lot from it and you learn from it.
Yeah, there's some great depth there. And I think it's definitely a position that will be strong for Ireland for quite a while. So just before we call it a day, Pat has one for you, Mike. So with 5 minutes to go, Nigel Owens penalised the Ireland scrum inside the New Zealand 22 in Christchurch in 2012. Mm-hmm. The All Blacks went up the other side of the pitch and won through a Dan Carter drop goal. Did Nigel Owens make the right call on the scrum penalty that day?
Not at all. I think Keane had gone up and he called us for wheeling, and there wasn't a wheeling.
No?
No. Nigel has some history in giving important decisions and, you know, when Ireland are playing New Zealand.
I remember playing that day, particularly disappointing, but...
Because, lost well in previously. I was just coming back from a hamstring injury, so it was my first game in about 4 or 5 weeks after the pro. I think we lost to Ospreys in the pro 14 final. But it was a cold, wet day in Christchurch.
We were probably doing well to draw the game. I remember from playing, and really that was kind of one of those ones. But
and we kind of poked the bear, because next week they went out and they slaughtered us 60-0. Mm. We lost a few for injuries, and that was unfortunately.
But cheers, guys, and cheers to everybody for watching and listening. A big thanks to producer Pat Paul, Anthony Dermott, and everybody that helped getting the show together. This is House of Rugby Ireland here on Joe.
House of Rugby Ireland here on Joe. Game changed.